The April 23rd, 2019 joint study session of the National Planning Commission and the Housing and Human Services Commission. Welcome to everyone. Thank you all for being here. We did talk to Councilor Seth Seffinger and Dennis Slattery as well, who said they were very interested in this, and then when Bill told them that they're going to get the same briefing in 2 weeks, they said maybe we'll work on the budget, maybe their time is better spent on the budget. So they're here with us in spirit. Do we have any announcements?
Just real quickly, I think most of you saw that the City Council upheld the Planning Commission's decision for the cottage housing project. And then also, we've been trying to get a date for the Planning Commission retreat, and we haven't been able to get all seven of you to agree on one date. So what we're thinking, and I'll send out an email tomorrow, is that we don't have anything planned for the regular Planning Commission meeting in May 14th, Tuesday. And so we're thinking about possibly doing like a 3 to 7 o'clock as a possible, because you already have it marked on your calendars. But I'll send you something out, and then we can provide some other options as well. So.
Okay, that's a great idea. Thank you, Bill. Do we have anyone for the public forum?
We do. She's filling out the form. If you'd like to fill out the form.
Am I it? You are it.
I think you're it. If you could just give your name before you get started, you have 3 minutes.
So, I'm River Shirley Fairhurst, and I'm currently the pastor of the United Methodist Church in Ashland East, but I have 34 minutes, is what you said?
3 minutes. Not sermon length, sorry.
Everybody already knows me. Well, most people know me here. I know what I'm going to say. We have to be faithful to the pledges that we made about how we were going to fund housing in Ashland. Those pledges were hard won, right? I know that it seems super easy to say, boy, we have this scary shortfall. There might be some low-hanging fruit. There might be some folks who won't mind as much, or maybe we won't disturb as much if we borrow from, let's say, the marijuana account and raid the housing account. So I have total empathy for budget woes. Believe me, I'm a pastor. Churches are not rolling in funds. And I know that churches like cities, they seek to be and offer services to the people that they serve, and are mindful of that. And I know you're all mindful of that, so I appreciate that very much. But let's face it, marijuana taxes, a lot of the folks who don't have much turn to marijuana, use marijuana, try to grow marijuana to get rich. Let's not tax the poor and then take away their taxes to help fund those who are like coming with extra money to spend in Ashland. There's a beautiful, beautiful giant building going up next to Pioneer Hall, like a great community center. We need to be mindful of where our dollars are going and remember that we are on a trajectory as a country to create more poverty. We are creating poverty. Those are folks who aren't going to be skilled employees. Those are folks who are going to struggle in school. Those are folks who are going to struggle to have stability and to teach stability to their children. So we are ground zero for how we are going to tax and how we are going to spend in budget. And as we say in churches, budgets are a moral document. Ashland is a very moral place. It prides itself on that. And so I'm going to say, and I know there's a lot of people who feel as I do, that we can't keep... We must try to fund housing, not at the level that we are, but far beyond it. We must have the will to shift the trajectory for our children so that we can have the benefits of Ashland for 100 years and not 15. Amen?
Amen. Thank you, Pastor. Anyone else, Dana?
No, that was it.
Okay, thank you. We have one item on the agenda tonight, which is a discussion item, the Housing Strategy Implementation Plan. You saw part of before, I think, and my understanding, and Brad can explain more about the trajectory of this document and project, is this is intended to be a technical document, not, you know, an appendix to the comprehensive plan or the implementation standard of the comprehensive plan. But, you know, it's information, technical information that will assist, you know, our commissions and the city council in considering, you know, eventually, maybe later this year, potential some changes that could, you know, that could encourage multifamily housing management. And the timing of it is key to, as Brandon will tell us, key to a state grant for that purpose. The state wants this technical document first, and then it will come back to the commissions and to the city council for potential action items. Is that right, or did I? Well,
okay,
thank you.
So I'll get started, and my first point of order is to introduce Becky Hewitt, who is here from Eco Northwest. She's been the project manager on this and one of the principal authors on the document before you. I do know that they do have a team that we've been consulting with, and so it's not a singular effort, but a number of Eco Northwest and City of Ashland staff have been working to produce the draft document that's before you. And this is in terms of what Commissioner Pierce was referencing. I want to give a little bit further context and background of how we got here. It starts with the regional problem solving, 12 years in the making in terms of creating a document that would address how our region will develop once the population is two times what it was when it started. As part of that regional housing plan, there was a component, and I'll get into in a moment, that there be a housing plan, a regional housing plan created, and housing strategies that were done. As part of that effort, the Department of Land Conservation and Development funded Eco Northwest to develop housing strategies for each of the jurisdictions that were participating. And you guys saw that document in October and November, and City Council saw that in November as well. And additionally, the housing strategy and implementation plan that's before you tonight is really the next step of that, looking at that broad brush approach.
Yes. Can I ask a question about that? Because it really concerns a lot what's happening on the Housing and the Service Commission. And there were five components, five goals within that overall strategy. And we've had a subcommittee that's been looking in real detail about all those and really particularly focused on four and five. But I noticed when we got this notice that we were looking at the strategies, we were looking at the zoning parts of that. Is there going to be an opportunity to also go to...
There will, and I'll get into why we're looking at these specifically at this point a little bit later in my brief introduction here. But in short, because this was a state grant that was based on the City of Ashland being a rent-burdened community, they were looking at us to look at those strategies that would increase rental housing as a means of addressing that housing need. The land use and the tax abatement is an area where using outside consultant expertise was helpful in terms of outlining some of the strategies that we could look at. Some of those others, like goal, Policy 5, the construction excise tax, those things, the City of Ashland likely has the internal expertise to work on that and put that forward to the City Council.
So what is the timeline look? Because we're moving this part along.
Right.
Is there a concomitant timeline for the other pieces?
At this point, no. We don't have a timeline for those. We're really looking at addressing these to complete this draft document by June 30th of this year as a final document in order to meet the grant parameters. Subsequent to that, then we would be going through the land use process, I guess I can get to that. We would be drafting code amendments and resolutions in order to bring those forward. And I think it really does get to an assessment of how much staff time there is available to carry these things through. They're not mutually exclusive. So if ultimately the council directed staff to work on policy 3 or policy 5 instead of policy 2 and policy 4. That is something that we can look at.
And then the Housing Human Services would have some input into that timeline.
Right. And again, we haven't drafted timelines even for the code amendments on this. We just know that it was part of the grant funding that we received was to draft this strategy, and ultimately that will lead to a legislative process. So I'll quickly go through the regional problem solving. The reason that was done was because there was a lack of coordination among the region, and those regional planning efforts were looking at areas of affordable housing, transportation, economic development, smart growth practices, really in an effort to help businesses increase jobs and support schools, and obviously the creation of affordable housing or even additional housing for the general market is part of that equation. Specifically in relation to growth, Ashland didn't elect to include any new areas for urban expansion. So really looking that we're going to grow within our existing urban growth boundary to accommodate future population growth. And that leads us to needing to address efficiency in terms of efficient use of land that's available, and better transportation planning as well. And so another city council request that got incorporated into that regional plan was that the housing strategies be adopted on a regional basis. And so Eco Northwest has worked with each community within the region to do a code audit focused on the provision of needed housing. And additionally, the strategies included for potential reforms were outlined for each jurisdiction, and they're not all the same. Obviously, when they looked at Ashland's code, they saw areas for improvement. When they looked at what policies we already had in place, for instance, waiving systems development charges for affordable housing, that wasn't a needed strategy for Ashland, but was one recommended for a number of the nearby communities. And so each community is currently evaluating those strategies, which brings us to what I brought up when speaking to Commissioner Rohde, is that the Department of Land Conservation and Development, recognizing that Ashland is a rent burden community, did offer us a grant, and there was a really short timeline in terms of preparing the grant application to the state, so we did take it to the City Council, and they gave approval to make requests for those grant funds. And they were awarded at the end of last year, the beginning of this year. Work started in terms of these items that were outlined in that memorandum of understanding. A couple things that they do address is, again, that policy two to encourage development of new multifamily areas, new multifamily and area zone for multifamily housing, and in commercial areas by increasing the amount and density of multifamily development. So this is where the memorandum of understanding focused on this specific action, and the creation of multifamily housing is largely the focus of the implementation plan being reviewed this evening. And specifically, it's looking at evaluating opportunities to increase densities in R2 and R3, our multifamily zones, evaluating opportunities to increase building heights, looking at lot coverage, increasing lot coverage, and evaluating lot coverage as well. And lastly, evaluating parking requirements to see if they could be reduced, again, to incentivize multifamily housing. I should state that each of these are being evaluated in the context of changes to the multifamily development standards, which is that land use that Commissioner Rohde was alluding to. The other portion of the document before you is evaluating opportunities to implement tax abatement programs such as the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program. You're all familiar with the Vertical Housing Tax Credit Program, which we've been moving forward with on a separate track. Both of these would be addressed by talking to those taxing jurisdictions simultaneously. And this was listed as Policy 4. So the grant objectives that were put forth in the memorandum of understanding approved by council had really the task of conducting a code audit, looking at the financial returns for sale versus rental housing, and understanding the existing market conditions nationally, and evaluating the impacts of that multiple unit limited tax exemption. And additionally, this is a small point, but review the impact of Ashland's annexation policies and approval standards on multifamily residential land supply. I'll speak a little out of turn before the presentation from Becky in that currently we have a requirement that there be at least a 5-year supply of land within the city limits, or less than a 5-year supply of land within the city limits before you can annex property into the city. As we're examining questions about whether you increase density from multifamily zone land, that would theoretically increase the supply of housing that could be accommodated in the city and may have an unintended chilling consequence of not allowing annexation. So that's why we want to look at whether that 5-year supply is serving its intent. And lastly, the recommended code amendments that we talked about being intended to remove obstacles that are currently maybe part of why multifamily housing is not being developed in those zones. And so with that, again, I'd like to introduce Becky Hewitt to come forward. And while she's coming forward, I'm going to open up her presentation. Unless you guys had any questions for me.
Yeah, any questions about this sort of the process of what this document is about for Brandon when we get into the structure?
Something like the final product that has come back to each of our commissions before it was out after the study session?
That's my understanding. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so a final product in terms of the housing implementation plan is going to the City Council this draft on May 6th, and the comments that we receive from you tonight will help inform the next version of it. The comments we receive on May 6th from the Council will help inform the next version. And then that document will be provided to the City before the June 30th deadline, at which point it's ours to use in terms of forming a land use process if we so choose to go forward with one. I think it's our expectation that we will. We'll also be looking at whether Department of Land Conservation and Development has any further grant funding in the next fiscal year, beginning on July 1, that could, again, provide assistance in moving forward with the selected strategies.
Actually, I have a question.
Yeah.
Because it's something that's not covered in this, and I just wonder about rezoning property. You brought up, and I'm interested in exploring more the question about annexation, but we all know that multifamily housing zoned land is very scarce. There's very little R3, not a lot of R2 in the city at all. And do we ever talk about potentially rezoning land that's in the zone for something else now?
In the original housing strategy document, there was the recommendation to look at R13.5, R15, and R175, and R110. Those are all single-family zones, and see if there's opportunity for upzoning those to allow either higher density in R13.5 or look at opportunities for R2 or R3 in those zones. So that is something that the city could do. It's not something that the housing implementation strategy goes into would require looking at where would you be able to accommodate land area in existing neighborhoods that had essentially the most opportunity to create multifamily housing on available land, as opposed to physically constrained lands, floodplains, steep slopes. Those areas that are largely vacant in those zones may not be suitable for multifamily. But that would be a different analysis. I don't know if Bill has any comments on that or anyway.
No, I mean, as Brandon said, it's not covered in this portion, but it has been identified. But as you'd expect, it's very time consumptive, and it will likely be very controversial. So it's something we probably want to vet first with the city council to see if they'd want to take a look at.
It's a very low priority because this would be controversial.
Well, I mean,
I'm not challenging that idea.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, and I'm not sure how much more productive that might be before first looking at some of these.
Yeah. I would say that, you're familiar with the cottage housing ordinances recently passed. The last zone change that I'm familiar with from single-family zone to multifamily zone was for a co-housing development in Ashland. And in that development, you know, it needed that zoning in order to consolidate parking as opposed to individual parking spaces for individual units and some other things. The cottage housing ordinance were in place at that point in time. The applicant would not necessarily have had to go through a zone change to accommodate that number of units, consolidated parking, consolidated open space.
Anything else?
I think I read something in this report about selectively inviting certain properties to apply to come into the city. And I assume that means large tracts of land that could potentially be used for multifamily dwelling. And I was curious about how that could work.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that could work. I'm not familiar with the process to reach out to property owners to come into the city. Typically, our annexation is property owner driven. Mm-hmm. They have property they want to bring to the city, and they approach the city for annexation. Our first point back to them is they have to demonstrate there's less than 5 years supply of that type of land in the city. Mm-hmm. And that's the strategy that we're focusing on in the housing implementation strategy.
Anything else? Becky, you're up.
All right, thank you. So thank you all for having me down here. It's lovely, lovely getting to come down to Ashland. Brandon did a great job of kind of setting the stage of what we were asked to look at with this project and why. And so this is kind of a restatement of what Brandon already said, but we took our scope and the way that we kind of focused our efforts and framed things was to say, what are the obstacles to multifamily rental housing and development in Ashland, both market conditions as well as code obstacles? Would changing development standards for in the multifamily zones, would that help with those obstacles? And could the property tax exemption, which I apologize, gets called different things by different people in different times, so sometimes called MUFTI or multiple unit property tax exemption, sometimes called MULTI. It's all the same thing, not two different things. So if I say one and you're expecting to hear the other, just know we're still talking about the same thing. Some of you are probably very familiar with your zoning map, but just in case anybody isn't, I wanted to start with just what zones we're talking about, R2 and R3, and one of our members has already pointed out that there's not a huge amount of land, but there's two places where it is zoned in the city are highlighted here. And the southern one is partially within the transit triangle and subject to that overlay. So what our process was, we started with gathering, analyzing some demographic and market data. Some of this work had already been done through your housing needs analysis, through the regional problem-solving studies. We tried not to recreate the wheel and pull every possible thing, but just focus on things that would really help us kind of understand the dynamics between ownership housing and rental housing. We spoke with a couple of folks that are active in your development community locally, and then we created prototypical housing developments. So examples that are plausible, that are informed by what's happening in your market, but that are not any specific example that has or will come before you. So first up, the obstacles that we found to developing multifamily rental housing. You are probably somewhat aware of kind of trends, but just to put some numbers to it, there's not been a whole lot of multifamily building permits issued in the last 5 years. And the multifamily includes mixed use, so where it's over commercial. The single family does include town halls as well. It's not broken out here. But you've had a relatively small number of multifamily permits over the last 5 years and much stronger single family housing production. The probably biggest reason for this, construction costs are high throughout the state. That's not unique in Ashland, but it's also true in Ashland. What is a little more unique in Ashland is that the land costs are also very high. And so the combination of those things plus your fees and process and everything else that are not, your fees are not exceptional, your process, maybe there's more appeal than there might be in some other communities. All those things combined mean that you need to be able to get pretty high rents or sales prices in order to make it work. But, and this again may not come as a surprise to anyone here, the demand for rental housing in particular is at lower income levels. So folks that are making less than $35,000 a year, who might be service workers, they might be retirees living on Social Security, they are not able to pay premium rents. By contrast, you've got a lot more of your homeowners that have more resources available. And although there are some renters in those upper income bands, it's a pretty thin market. So you can potentially hit, you know, it's possible to pick them up and create housing for them. If you think about how many units really could you produce for that small number of households that wants to rent and has an income. Ownership market is stronger between the fact that you have higher income households and the fact that you have a lot of folks coming in with equity from other places. So this chart shows, just for condominiums, just in the last couple of years, how many of the transactions had a 20% or less down payment, somewhere between 20 and 90, or more than 90, meaning basically an all-cash transaction. You can see that a lot of the transactions are all-cash. You have a fair number of folks coming in with equity. That makes it a lot easier to sell condos or sell houses. Also, financing for apartments is hard. This is true in any small market. You have big dollars and small pond, and you need to get a loan to do development. The bank is worried not just about whether your rents are going to cover your loan payments, but also, if you screw this up and you go belly up, I need to be able to find somebody else to buy this property because I don't want to get stuck holding it. So how many people have the capital to invest in a larger apartment building and are willing to invest in a small market? It's not a lot. So that's one thing that is particular to rental housing that is not necessarily the case with condominiums. Condominiums, townhouses, you sell them to individual buyers. It's not this big lump sum. You don't have quite the same issue about a limited pool of potential buyers. And so banks are a little less nervous when they can kind of sell them off one at a time. And so we heard from folks that in some cases they are even, and this is very unusual in the rest of the state, building things at the condominium up front in order to get the financing. Because the bank is more willing to loan the money that way, it gives them an out. But intending to hold them as rentals. Again, that doesn't happen in a bigger market where financing isn't an issue, but in Ashland, it does. So that's all on that section. What I'm going to do is just give an opportunity for kind of clarifying questions on each of these as we move through, just so you don't have to try to remember your clarifying questions for too long, but we're going to try to hold off on kind of the real meaty discussion of what everybody thinks about all this until we've been through all of it, if that's okay with you. So clarifying questions on the obstacle piece?
I guess you were clear.
Okay. Feel free to think of something.
I'll add a question. I mean, how much do we look at other factors besides just finances and obstacles to renting or building rental houses? I remember when we were doing I can't remember which one of the zones that we were doing the special project, normal, and there was an overwhelming NIMBY output of people that really said that renters are really evil. I mean, I sat and listened to all that, and I wondered whether that's a factor also in as we look at how we're dealing with increasing rental units.
I would say certainly opposition. Neighborhood opposition could be a concern for any kind of multifamily, and maybe more so for rental. We didn't hear specifically that there was greater opposition for multifamily rental housing than for condo. So this first pass is just what are the key things that differentiate between ownership versus rental if it was the same shape? And the issues that I identified are things where it could be the same exact shape of building and it would still be easier to build it as ownership than as rental. I think the public opposition piece is, it's certainly possible that there would be greater opposition to rental housing. It's not something we specifically heard mentioned.
Yeah, one thing I might relay on that topic is to the degree that we're capable of creating clear and objective land use standards that apply universally to the building form, whether it's an apartment or a condominium. If you're permitted to have X number of units and X number of parking spaces, there may be neighborhood opposition, but it has to be in terms of evaluating that planning application. It would have to relate to that the application didn't meet the criteria of approval. So I do think it's incumbent upon us and the commissions to ultimately recommend clear and objective planning criteria that, in a sense, would nullify any kind of NIMBY opposition based on occupants as opposed to the building type.
That's required by state law.
It is.
I know what I was going to say. Yep, thank you.
So tell me if this is not in the right spot, but I wanted to ask about a couple of data points that I thought were interesting, that Ashland has a higher proportion of multifamily and single-family attached housing units than Jackson County or the state. So I thought that was interesting, that a third of our housing units are actually multifamily or single-family attached. And then on page 12, on page, that's on page 9, demographic and market data. And then on page 11, Ashland has a lower home ownership rate than the county or the state, meaning that we have a higher percentage of rental occupied rather than owner occupied homes. So to me, those data points tend to suggest that it isn't that we don't have enough units, multifamily rental, it's that they're expensive. Am I?
Those things are related, for sure. I would say you probably have both problems. So the fact that you have more multifamily than other parts of the county, to me, I guess it, now, especially having seen a little bit more of Ashland, I think the fact that you do have condominiums, you do have townhomes, you do have a market that can support development of certain types of multifamily is probably part of the reason why it's greater in Ashland. Also, if you think about the county as a whole and how much of it is rural, just the rural versus urban piece. I apologize that I don't have the numbers ready to hand for how Ashland compares to the other cities in the county. So it may be less different than Bedford, for example.
So you're kind of coming up with rationales for the data, but I'm just pointing to the data that we actually have more multifamily, but it's expensive. And I think if the problem is framed in that way, it might result in a different solution. So that's the only reason I'm raising it, is that it may be that it's about price more than numbers.
And I agree with that. The place where I would want to maybe put a nuance on it is that supply and price are related. So to the extent that you can expand supply, and we'll get to this in a moment, but new development tends to hit at a pretty high price point for reasons we just talked about. So it does not, new market rate development does not directly create affordability. What it does do is take the pressure off your existing housing. So to the extent that you may have more supply than the county as far as multifamily, but if you're not keeping up with the pace of population growth and the pace of need and demand for multifamily rental housing, then you're still driving prices up more than you would be if you were adding supply and keeping up with the pace of demand.
So if you add even more expensive units that are being built now, the idea is somehow the overall cost is going to decrease because there's more units on the market.
It's sort of easier to think about is if you don't add new supply. If there isn't new supply where your folks that can afford it can choose to rent, then they will tend to drive up the rents of your other housing. And over time, some of those property owners might say, hey, I can make a little more money if I start rehabbing these units. And maybe I'll go ahead and, you know, freshen up my kitchens and bathrooms and start trying to turn things over. So it's really more about what happens in the absence of new supply and how your overall housing market responds when supply is constrained.
We do have low vacancy rates, right?
I wish we had better vacancy data. From what we can see, they appear to be fairly low. I don't have robust data for how they compare to some place like Bedford or the rest of the state. It's hard to get really good data in a small market. Any other questions before we move on to the development codes? Okay. So, hold on, jump ahead. All right, so, in testing the zoning code, we did this in kind of two pieces. One was just capacity of the land. How many units could you fit, assuming that you could, that money was not a problem? How much development could you fit if you varied the different development standard levers that we were asked to look at? Parking, density, lot coverage, height. If you vary those four levers, how much does that matter to the development potential of the site? Part two is where we say, okay, now can you actually make the finances work on any of those things? But first we're going to start with part one, just sort of physical capacity. So first piece, how many units are on a typical site? Talking to staff, it sounded like a typical site in the city, zoned R2 or R3, about a half acre or an acre was a useful example to test. So we tested those two sizes. We didn't find any real big differences between the two, so I'm mostly going to just use the 1 acre example. But we did look at both. Our next step was to create these prototypical, these example buildings, and max out how many units could you do under the existing development code. So we tested out a couple of different mixes of unit size and unit type. So three different variations of rental housing. One that had a pretty typical mix of things you might see in a garden apartment building kind of anywhere in the state. It's got some studios, one bed, some two beds, a couple three beds. We tested one that is all studio, all under 500 square feet, because you have some code incentives already for those very small units. And then we tested one that is all four bedroom, because you are seeing both of those extremes come to fruition. And there are reasons for it that we'll get to in a minute. But we tested both of those types of units. And then we tested a sort of prototypical condo style with a mix of 1, 2, and 3 beds, larger units, because you tend to see larger units with condos. So four different kind of flavors of what's inside of the box. And then we started testing the changes to key development standards to say how many additional units on our example sites could you get if you made these changes. The things we tested were height. We looked at increasing from 2.5 stories to 3 stories. We only tested out the R3 zone. The reason for that, I know that in the transit triangle, both of them are allowed to go higher. But the reason for that is that in looking at kind of the purpose of the zones, we felt like the R2 zone was really kind of trying to be more of a transition and a kind of more medium density, and that maybe increasing it to 3 stories was not appropriate citywide. So we only tested that for the R3 zone. You'll notice, and you can tell from these pictures, 2.5 stories works a heck of a lot better for townhomes than it does for garden apartments. So this is a pretty key change in enabling a pretty just standard, vanilla, multifamily rental development. Then we also tested changing the density limits. So right now you have a an outsider perspective on your zoning code. You have very low density limits in these zones. 20 units per acre is very, very low. And so with that kind of density limit, you get fewer large units and then if you increase the density, you could get more smaller units. I noted you do have code incentives for the very small units, but they're still not really enough to get just on the density standards you have to really get to something that makes sense. So right now, because you can't add more units and you have all this space left on your site, you may as well make them bigger units. How else are you going to make more money? So That's what you're getting right now. We also looked at lot coverage, so how much of the site is left in landscaping. We tested just some pretty small changes to lot coverage. You really need to do a lot of the other things first before lot coverage becomes your problem, but we did look at it. And then we also looked at parking, how many spaces are required per unit. Again, with the low density standards you have right now, it's not really a problem, but when you start to take some of the other obstacles out of the way, you want to use parking. And the main issue with parking does directly increase cost because each surface parking spot costs money, but mostly, and when you're talking about a surface parking lot, it's really about how much space you have to pave versus how much you can put a building on. But again, when you start to increase the density so that you can actually put building on more of your lot, then having a big parking area becomes a problem. So this chart shows four of those four different kind of mixes of how unit sizes and types with your existing zoning, and then we also looked because we are aware that you have some density bonus provisions, so we said, okay, well, how far can you get if you do a few of those density bonuses, and then what if you increase, this is just the R3 example here, so what if you increase height and density only, don't do anything else, just go to three stories and you pull density up basically until you run into other stuff. And depending on the unit mix, going just that far, just height and density, you are close to 30 units an acre on some of these, and then over 60 on the all studios. When you take into account the fact that studios only count as 3/4 of a unit, so you can get a lot more of them. And then if you also add the parking reduction and a lot coverage increase, you really see a big increase in the achievable density. R2, same pattern, but just to give a sense of where those numbers land, you're starting at about 13 units per acre right now as your base. And with the first kind of thing we tested was just density. Don't change anything else. Don't allow a higher height. Don't reduce the parking. Don't increase the lot coverage. Just let the density run up to whatever it's going to be. And that gets you 20 to over 40 units to the acre, again, without changing the form of the development very much. And then if you also reduce parking and increase the lot coverage slightly, then you get even higher on the high end. It doesn't change things all that much for the bigger units, but those smaller units, you really see the number of units you can accommodate jump up. So takeaways from this, density is by far your biggest limitation right now. The lot coverage and the other standards aren't a problem with your current density. If you increase that density, then you might want to start baking in some tweaks to the other stuff. The low limits are encouraging large units rather than small. So even though you have, you're sort of pushing people to one extreme or the other, either a really big unit or the really small to try to get all the bonuses and the incentives. And the increases, allowing those greater increases that disproportionately benefits those small units. So the extent you're trying to encourage people to build smaller units, this really helps the small units in particular. Any questions about that piece before I go on to the financial feasibility part of it? Okay, I'll keep rolling with this. You know,
one question, in terms of density, did you just thought about 40 per acre instead of 20 per acre, for example, and not trying to implement some sort of FAR scheme?
So, well, we kind of backed into a density number. We took off all the other limits first, set the density to like a gajillion units per acre, and then saw where do you run into the other stuff, and how many units to the acre are you at the point where you hit your height and your lot coverage and your parking, like the most that fit with a two-story or a three-story building. And then we said, okay, bring the density down to a gajillion to wherever it starts to be roughly in line with what your other standards are allowing, because it's very alarming to people in the community if you say our maximum density is a gajillion units an acre. It's less alarming if you have a number. I don't have any objection to floor area ratio standards. It can also help encourage smaller units. We were trying to for a more apples-to-apples comparison, just say, what would it translate to if you kind of took, if you took that away as a limitation, it puts you about that 40 or 60 units in a year. Okay, so next up, we took a look at financial feasibility of those prototypical developments, given local rent, sale prices, construction costs, and fees. These are the rent and sales price assumptions we use. Again, we're talking new construction, so they are not going to be super-duper affordable, but they're still hitting the rents in particular on the low end are... I think under 80% of your area median household, I'm not remembering the exact number there.
Yeah, I think we've determined that 1250 a month was targeting people at 100% area median income.
And it varies by household size, of course, but so they're high relative, they're high from some lenses, but still a lot more affordable than a lot of other options. So what we did to look at financial feasibility is we used a concept called residual land value, which is basically how much can a developer afford to pay for the land given their other costs and given their likely revenue from either rent or sales. So just to kind of illustrate that quickly, value of the development on the right, and then the cost of the development, so construction costs, design costs, architecture, engineering, et cetera, permit fees, and then the land budget is that light blue piece. That's how much they can afford to pay for land and have it not exceed the value that they're creating. If it's not feasible, it looks more like this, where the cost of the land puts them above what they can afford to pay, and there's a subsidy required, or it doesn't happen. So, yeah, this is a little hazy, but you can see it. So the threshold to keep in mind as we show some of these results, zero is a very important one. It has to be bigger than zero, or you can't do it even if you own the land outright since your grandfather's time and it's not really, the land isn't costing you anything. Everything has to be bigger than zero or it's not going to happen. And then we, from based on conversations with folks in the development community, that we put kind of the low and high end of what we heard for land cost in there, just as a reference point. Should say as a disclaimer, all of these things, that any little variation in what you assume for rents and construction costs, these numbers can move around quite a bit. So it's important to kind of get a feel for how they compare to each other. And then to some degree, how they compare to these thresholds is important, but just remember that these are examples. Any example might come in with different rents, different number of units, different anything, and might be a different picture. They're illustrative. So the first one, this is our kind of typical garden apartment rental mix. This one does not do very well. This one does not make enough to pay for its construction costs, let alone for land. And what you're seeing here is as you move from, let's see, your left to right, you have, how much can it afford to pay for land? This is on a per square foot basis. With the existing zoning, what if it's a density bonus? And then what if we increase the capacity more? Now, why is that going down? Why is it getting worse? If you can't, if you're not making money on one unit, you don't want to build a lot of them, right? The more you are losing money on every unit. So the more you build, the more you lose. The incremental cost savings of a little less parking and a little more efficient building doesn't help you enough to make it worth the cost of construction for this one, and that's partly because we're assuming that this is not getting super premium rents, it's getting decent rents, but not super premium. So without the super premium rents, it just doesn't work.
Can you describe the mix of rental units?
So this is some studios, one beds, two beds, and three beds. And really the thing that kills it is those bigger units. The bigger units, they don't, the rent on a per square foot basis starts to fall off. So you can get pretty premium rents on a really small unit because people will pay a certain amount just to have a unit, and that, when the unit gets really small, Sun Belt very high on a per square foot basis. The other ones that you're seeing recently, which are a little bit anomalous in Ashland, but those four bedroom example, that is assumed based on local precedent to be leased by the bedroom. And so by leasing it by the bedroom, you can charge more on a per square foot basis again. So those are finding that little niche in the market where you can capture those premium rents. And so you'll see, this is the one that's four bedrooms. You can see it's kind of hovering right around that zero mark before. And then in the case of this one, it's got just enough value that when you start to give it more development potential, it gets up to where it can start to pay from the end. And then the studio one, again, it's kind of like feasible in special cases, but when you start to give them a lot more units, now you're talking. One consideration here on the studio one in particular, as we go through these, is how many studios for a super premium price point are really going to be needed in Ashland. So these ones that are kind of a narrow niche market where they can capture a premium rent, again, you have to think about the depth of the market in these places. So it works, but I don't know how many of them you could reasonably expect. But it does help. The density does help. So what we're seeing here is that if you have a product that where on a sort of per unit basis, they can generate enough value to cover their costs, more units, much better. Really helps. If you're not generating enough value to cover your costs, density's not going to help you. We added in also the condominium as a comparison here. So the condominium is that red line. So condominium starts out pretty feasible, gets a little better, a little less of a bump than some of the other ones, but it's moving upward as well.
Can I ask a question if that's fine? So on the Planning Commission, one of the things that we've been running into with our multifamily projects that we've been seeing here recently is neighborhood concern over parking. And even our existing parking, particularly the four-bedroom example that we raised, lots of complaints that people are really worried that you're going to end up with a lot more cars, and even our current parking standards aren't going to put them on site. And so the roads are going to be clogged, and the intersections are going to be congested, and there isn't going to be enough parking. And we've run into that in multiple situations. So looking at this sort of benefit here, at least on my chart, maybe it's a little bit hard to see, but I'm wondering about whether the difference of adding in the parking reduction and the lot coverage increase is producing enough of a benefit to outweigh the concerns that the public in Ashland has with adjustments to parking particularly.
I think that is a great conversation for the discussion y'all are going to have at the end of this presentation. I think that is that's policy. What I can tell you is what it does for capacity and what it does for development feasibility, but what you all have to think about is what that means for you and whether that makes sense in your community. Yeah?
Does it matter the increase in land cost? Take it kind of from the slide, the land cost is an additional factor kind of outside of the, what you're showing us on the slide. And my concern is that as we adapt and we up zone, the R3 land will just get a lot more expensive, which is how the unit works. So is that baked in here somewhere?
It's an astute observation. So to some degree, yes, if you made it so that lots more people could pay more for land, some of that is going to be captured in the land value. The hope would be that it's not 100%, but the land value, it's kind of hard to stop the land, the development potential from being capitalized into the land value. But what you're doing, the other thing that you're doing here is you're shifting who can afford to pay how much for land. So part of the reason that this is relevant is how rental competes with condo for land. Right now, condominium developer can afford to pay more for land, so if it goes up on the market, they're probably going to win. If you can build more small units and you can make it work for the small units as rental, you start to be able to outcompete condominiums. So even if the land cost does increase a little bit, you might see a different balance of being able to bring rental housing versus condominium housing forward. But it is true that, and this is going to be even more applicable as we see the later slides with the tax abatement thrown in, as you are creating more potential for higher land prices, I would say some of that might get absorbed. On the other hand, you have a pretty limited land supply already. Your land costs are very high here relative to other places. So my guess is that you would see some increase, but that your prices are already so sort of inflated by the limited supply of available land that you wouldn't see that much more of an increase.
But you wrote that into as a caveat to your record, footnote 3 on page 3. You write that in as a caveat to the whole recommendation. That you can just find that some of that benefit is going to be just absorbed by higher land costs.
Some of it probably will be. Some of it can also, so the places where that additional, again, when we get to the tax abatement, this is more relevant, but if you're seeing like, wow, this looks super feasible, what probably will happen is a little bit of increase in land cost, a little bit of the developer being able to make a more normal return that they might make in a bigger market. We had to model this with kind of returns that Portland developers will not accept. Developers here have to be willing to take a lower return than a sort of big city developer would demand. So to some degree, you might get developers seeing a little bit more of a return. Now, that's probably not what you're trying to accomplish, but if developers can make a little bit more money now, more people are probably interested in developing. Because you're not only picking up the people who are willing to do it at a discount, you're starting to pick up people who are like, oh, Ashland. Yeah, I can think about developing in Ashland. So you maybe increase the number of people who are willing to move development forward. And finally, you're creating the possibility of being able to do development without the super premium rents. You're creating more possible options that can work. So in some cases, like the best sites, that might go into a lot of land value. Other cases, it might go into a new developer who wasn't otherwise interested in the Ashland market, who comes in and gets to take on a little bigger chunk than their local buddies were doing. And in some cases, it might mean you can bring in a product that you couldn't make it work before, because you can start to mix in some of those lower per square foot rents that you couldn't make work before.
When you say land costs are high here compared to other places, and I know Eastern Northwest does stuff everywhere, is that comparing us to Bend or hip and cool parts of Portland, or what is that compared to?
Yeah.
We're pretty cool here.
I don't have great land cost numbers for all of the places I would like to be able to compare you to, like recent ones.
How do we compare to Bend?
You know, I don't have perfect numbers, I don't have recent numbers for Bend. This is going to look into and report back the council meeting, but Eugene, I think, was seeing in the kind of $6 to $12 per square foot for land range. So the bottom end of that is similar to the bottom end of your range. It's really the top of your land costs for the kind of best sites is more like what you would see in probably parts of Portland. And in Bend, I'm trying to think, the only recent information I have is from looking at total property costs, not just bare land. And
curious when you say we're still out of bounds, I'd just be curious to put more.
I would say you're well above other communities. your size. Mm-hmm. You're not necessarily well with other communities of your hipness.
That's really the Lynn's point about, you know, we can build all the supply we want, but if the demand's still there, the price is still going to be outrageous. Mm-hmm. So maybe we do need to create so many studios that we have a glut, and then that will impact price.
I would say that it, in general, if so, part of the reason that the land costs are high is because it's hip, and part of it is because, well, there's issues that constrain folks' ability to get actually buy land. There's folks that aren't willing to part with their land. There's annexation limitations. So when pieces do come up that are buildable and zoned for multifamily, there are residential at all, those few pieces are going to get to come in. So if you combine these with the annexation, make it a little easier to annex new land, that might be a sort of go the other direction. One set of changes might push your land values up, but the other set of changes would help keep them from getting too high because then, okay, I'll just annex a different piece of land that isn't going to cost me that much money. Is that a question?
Well, just to clarify what you're saying, it sounds to me like what you're saying is if we change our annexation policies, we, with more land available, we'll push prices down, and that would make it more feasible to do the kind of housing we're talking about.
That's, yes. If there was more land available for development, you wouldn't be able to charge as much of a premium on the pieces that are currently in the city. So, takeaways from this, I've mostly already said that where you have something that's feasible, increasing the development capacity helps you be able to afford the land. The costs are too high, the density, the cost savings you get from a little more efficiency doesn't help, and these code amendments can help that kind of all studio, small unit, high value per square foot, outcompete condos if there's enough demand to build that many studio units. Last piece, property tax abatement. So there are two types of property tax abatements that could be applicable for multifamily rental housing that is not regularly affordable. One of the MUCU or MULTI, and this is the one that we were scoped to look at, so it's the one I'm going to actually present in some detail, but I did want to note the other one. So MUCU-MULTI is very flexible. City sets the eligibility criteria that can include location, certain features you want, certain densities you want, numbers of units, whatever. And it lasts for 10 years. It only applies to the value of the building and the improvements. It doesn't apply to the land value. There's a second, that one's been around for a while on the statute. The second one listed is a newer program. I think it dates to 2017. I'm not aware of any cities having implemented it yet. I haven't called every one. But none of the communities I've worked in have implemented it. The eligibility is pretty strictly set in the statute. It is basically rental housing where the rents are affordable at less than 120% of area median income. The one place where the city does get to control it is how long the abatement lasts. And you're supposed to have a sliding scale based on how many of the units are affordable at that level. In most places, all of your market rate multifamily housing pretty much is affordable at less than 120% AMI. May not be true for some products in Ashland, but still most market rate multifamilies that qualify. If you offer it to anybody, you have to offer it to everybody that qualifies. There's no sort of picking and choosing and beauty contest. And it applies to the value of the land and the improvements. So these, as you think about moving forward with tax payments, is another one just to keep in the back of your mind. So what we looked at is how much of the tax savings save the property owner, how would a developer value those tax savings over that 10-year period, how much would the city and other taxing districts be giving up in revenue, and then we looked at would the value be enough that you could demand a rent discount in exchange, and is that a good idea? So this is just for one example, just for year one, just to keep things simple for presentation purposes. This is in total, not on a per unit basis. So the developer would be saving a little under $40,000 for year one. Of that, the city is giving up about $11,000, and the rest is coming out of other districts. And because developers tend to value future savings less than savings right now, we discounted when we looked at how would they perceive the value they make, and we discounted those future years. And then in the report, we show what is the total, including 3% assessed value growth for the city and the tax payments. And if you get into thinking about adopting this, those are the numbers you want to think about. That's how much you would be giving up. So how this affects development feasibility, what to look at is the same shape, two different colors, before and after. So those arrows are showing you the tax, that example, this one is the all studio version, and how the combination of zoning changes and the tax abatement would affect the land value. So this is where I said, like, you're getting some really high numbers out of this. Probably not how it actually plays out. It's just showing that it's making it like definitely feasible, very feasible. Okay? If anybody wants to build that many studio units, great. And one of the other things that's important here is it's showing that if you don't do the zoning changes, but you do do the tax abatement, you can bump rental housing feasibility up. And the condo mix is shown faintly in gray here. And so potentially with the tax abatement, it can outcompete condo even without the zoning changes. Just if you give the tax abatement to rental and you don't give it to condo, then that tax savings helps them achieve a higher dollar value that can help them pay more for land. And then this is our ill-fated garden apartment traditional mix, which still, even with the tax abatement, with the, you know, set of rent assumptions that we made, still doesn't clear that $0 mark. But again, this is an example. It's totally possible that a variation on this theme might just tweak into feasible territory, but the example that we tested did not. Helps them, but doesn't necessarily get them far enough. So the takeaways, the abatement is definitely more powerful when you combine it with the zoning changes. And if you target it to rental housing specifically, it can compete better with condominiums and townhomes. And you could require that developers offer a rent discount in exchange for this program.
Can I ask what a rent discount is, as opposed to we have rent limitations where they have to hit certain percentage? Is there a difference, or is it using the same
term? We're talking about the same thing. This would be for market rate housing. Some of their units, they would have to have a rent limit and probably income qualify. You could make that a condition of
the percentage of the units that would have that.
If you do that, the concern is you have to think about whether you're doing enough things to help development feasibility that you've now created an opportunity to ask for something back in exchange. So if you don't do any zoning changes and you give this tax abatement, don't expect to get any units back that are discounted affordable. If you did all this stuff and now we're talking about these, like, some of these units are super feasible, maybe some of these can afford to give you a rent discount, but a lot of them probably can't. Not down to 60% of area median income. Maybe to 80, maybe
it could be subsidized in other ways.
So yes, you could certainly combine with other programs. The tax abatement lasts for 10 years. So if you are layering in another subsidy that has a different term of affordability, say 30 years, you just have to think about the longer one is going to win. So their affordability lasts for this long. The tax abatement is only lasting for this long. So the kind of run the numbers of how much I'm saving during these 10 years versus losing over 30. And there are other programs, I would say, if what you want is just to offer tax abatements for affordable housing, there are probably other programs that are better suited to that, other tax abatement options that are more specifically intended for the 60% and below and for nonprofit affordable housing. These, both of the multi-mufti and the other one that I mentioned, are really better for market rate. And in a place like Ashland, it actually has a pretty robust affordable housing program and already does compliance. Already has a compliance program. For your size, it is amazing. And for your hipness, it is so. The fact that you already have dedicated staff that's managing an affordable housing program means it's not out of the question to get into requiring affordability, but it's, there are maybe other incentives that work better for the truly capital A affordable, the housing that has other elements of the
question.
No.
So what sometimes I have conversations with folks and constituents on this kind of a structure, and it ends up getting down to the developers seem to do pretty well. And doesn't this boil down to a developer's pro forma, and then we're going to, that has a margin of a reward for the risk baked into it, and you're asking me to take tax dollars and subsidize their for-profit pro forma to what they would like in order to build the thing?
So the MUFTI program in particular requires that the city make a finding that the things that you are subsidizing would not have enough but for the tax payment. So by definition, if you are adopting this program, it's because your choice is not developer does it but doesn't make any money, or developer does it and makes money. The developer does it and doesn't make any money means the developer doesn't do it. So it's really, you would be trying to tailor it to instances where developers cannot make enough money doing it right now for them to bother. And if you offer this tax abatement, yes, they're going to make money on it. That's the only way they're going to build the housing. So you get the housing, they get to make enough money to cover their time and their risk.
Yes, that's the deal.
And again, it's not because you care about the developer's pocketbook per se. It's because you want the unit. So you have to, the thing that you're incentivizing has to be in line with your goals, and it has to be a thing that isn't happening on its own. And and with MUFTI, you can tailor it and say, like, this is what's eligible. It's rentals, this, maybe it's not studio units, maybe it's something else. You know, maybe it's only things that you really feel like we definitely want this and it's not happening. And we're willing to give tax, and you have other local subsidies that go to affordable housing, so maybe there's some band of lower cost market rate housing that makes sense for the city to subsidize. But those are the policy questions.
So I guess what I'm getting from this, looking at page 28, talking about the effect of these changes in zoning code and stuff, and how that might permit above the zero line certain types of developments to pencil, basically. And then also what we're getting when we apply these tax abatement strategies is that we might end up with all studio or all four bedroom developments. Those are really the categories that are going to be produced by both of these. And we still don't get rental mix. That's still not happening in either of these scenarios. So we're going to end up making these policy changes, increasing density, et cetera, to produce all studio. It's still not family housing. So now we have a situation where the family housing is in these rentals that are single family homes that are being rented, those other statistics that I was referring to. That's still the segment of the market that is going over there in the larger spaces. I wonder if the affordability of that is really impacted, because it might be different segments of the market.
I think you're right. You have different segments within your rental market. So you do have a fair number of 1 and 2 person households. So that's, you know, you've got 1 or 3 people in your household probably don't want to be in under 500 square feet. That's going to be really cozy. So you're going to have folks that want different things. I will say I'm not sure if we want an outcome of these things, but it is disappointing that none of these things really lift the sort of typical garden apartment mix into working. Again, I would say with the assumptions that we've made, and every development is going to be a little bit different. I think what I would take away from this is that right now it's studios and 4 beds really by the bedroom work. In future, it might be something else. But what I take away from this is where a developer can find some niche or some way that they can kind of fit something in and make it work, all of these things help. Whatever that product type is. That's not to say that you should indiscriminately subsidize everything with tax evasion. It might be that you say, all studios, great, fine, do it all day long if you want to, but I'm not going to give you any tax evasion for it. That's fine. You don't have to incentivize things that you feel like aren't meeting the needs. I would say that code incentives in particular are showing that anything you can do that gets you to a point where your unit is feasible, more of them is better. So again, studios, the smaller units, they get more benefit from it, but it might be that the next development will do half studios and half 1 bedrooms or something, and won't do all studios. So it's not necessarily that these exact things will be all that you will get. The ones that are still don't have a very high rent on a per square foot basis, those ones right now are going to continue to struggle. If that changes, if people are willing to pay more for 2 bedrooms in the future, if construction costs come down, these things can change over time. And
I'm just worried that, you know, we have the student population, so I think we want to be careful that we're not just building housing for students.
I think that when we did the rent burden analysis, it demonstrated that, I think, in terms of rental population, people that rent currently, nearly 3/4 of our population was 1 and 2 person households. And so that goes far beyond the student population and probably alludes to a large senior population as well.
Yeah, and when you look at the age breakdown, the proportion of renter households, different ages of the head of household, the 22 to 45, and in the lower income bands too. You've got folks on the street, you've got folks who are, some of them, you've got some students, but you've also got folks working service jobs and things like that. Now they're maybe not going to be able to pay for these new units either, but if they are in a 1 bedroom or a small thing, then you're not bidding up the cost of that one, that existing older 1 bedroom, if you're producing new supply.
Until they have a family and they have to move to Medford.
Right.
So I appreciate what you said a few moments ago about I'm not supposed to want an outcome, but here it is. Because, I mean, what I got out of the report here is that it looks pretty dismal, basically. And, you know, we could do a lot of back bends to try and come up with clever things to help, but it's not going to help that much. And this tax abatement thing is the only thing that seems to make a significant difference. However, I just want to point out, and I do hope that this will go to council, that we have had a proposal that we passed recently for a 4-bedroom complex and for a 500, a whole bunch of studios, and those people thought it was going to pencil out without us doing any of this. So I want us to be clear about that. You know, we just passed those, they haven't been built yet, but some people seem to think we can already do this without adding on a bunch of incentives. And they picked out the exact same results that you did.
Mm-hmm. Well, they informed our results. So one of the things we do is we put numbers in that we think are going to make sense, and then we look at the outcome. Is that match we're seeing in the market? So, for example, I mentioned that we had to assume a lower return rate than what Portland developers would typically expect. We had to say, all right, well, it looks like we're going to have to, press down on that, how much the developer is making, to match what we're seeing people actually doing. We can't say that nobody's building studio units, because they're trying. I will say one of the other folks we talked to, who's not the one building the studio units, questioned whether they were actually going to make any money on building the studio units. So not everyone agrees that they're feasible. But somebody does. Somebody thinks they are. And yes, I think the code amendments, each of these things can help, right? There are a couple of different layers of difficulty here. One is cost, and you're only in control of this much of it, of the cost side. Another one is financing, and you're not in control of the financing. None of this makes apartments easier to finance. Building a bunch more studio apartments isn't easier to finance. In some ways, it's maybe harder. But you can't do anything about that. And if people can build condos and then rent some of them, and now they can build more condos and rent more of them, incrementally, maybe helps. And then you have the capacity, the zoning capacity. So right now, I'm not going to say that these other two issues go away, but you are in control of your zoning. And your zoning is an obstacle to efficient, and in particular to efficient multifamily development that's not townhome. The folks that have brought projects forward, the shapes and sizes they've brought forward are not something you would expect to see in other markets. They are shaped by what is allowed. So they are making them work, but there might be more folks who would be tempted to try if it wasn't so hard. So I think that, in my mind, you should do what you can do and know that there's going to be obstacles that you can't really fix, and just try not to have the city be the problem. And then hope that they're able to put together a set of rents and construction costs that make sense. They're able to get a loan from a bank. They're able to overcome the other obstacles that you can't do very much to help them with. And at least just say, let us not be the problem.
I had just a general question about the zoning issues, and that is, have we factored in SB or House Bill 2001 that's, I think, likely to pass? And it sets out a whole bunch of standards for that for all cities above 20,000.
Yeah, and it largely sets forth standards in terms of what middle housing has to be accommodated in single-family zones. So the introduction of cottage housing,
right,
duplexes, triplexes, quads, yes, within single-family zones. This analysis was focused on our existing multifamily zones, which would have a higher density than even the House Bill.
So are we going to see something, if that passes, that reflects what happens on the state level?
I think if that passed, then cities would be obligated to look at how to incorporate that into our local land use code.
I'm just thinking about timing. I mean, I've heard different stories about where it's going, but it does sound, some of it sounds positive, and they make applications. Wouldn't we be better to wait until we see whether that passes and what the timeline for implementation of that is? Before making this?
Again, I think it addresses a different zone. So they're not necessarily exclusive, but if that is passed, my understanding is the state are probably also looking, DLCD would be looking at developing model code that cities could look at, and that may dictate the timeline as to when cities would then have.
It might be years before they get to it.
Brandon, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I look at that list of things that they're suggesting, we do almost all of that already.
We do almost all of those already.
So it's not going to make that
much
difference.
Well, we do the ARU, the no parking required, the on-street parking allowed. We do the cottage housing newly. As far as duplexes, we don't have that in our code currently. There was a provision to allow them on corner lots over a certain size, but we did an inventory of those corner lots that were vacant, and they're wasn't a supply of them. But there are some other items, triplex or quads, which aren't currently allowable in our single-family zones.
Yeah, it's really unclear what they're going to pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could just add one more point on that. The one other consideration, I think there's some efficiency in bundling things together, but bundling two things that could each individually be controversial, pitching them together might magnify the controversy. So you wouldn't necessarily want to hold back amendments to your multifamily zones because of concerns about duplexes, for example, that aren't getting at the same issue, even though I think there's some value for folks in just having it all sort of clearly handled at once. I think there is also a risk there.
The one thing I think needs to be made clear to the council on the four units that appears to work here, now under construction up on Park, is that with that project, they had the same parking requirement for three bedrooms as four bedrooms. I went back and looked at a number of zoning ordinances. I could not find any zoning or any place. It always, when they went, every time you go up a unit, the parking requirement goes up. And I don't know if that was a mistake when they did it, if they intended to do it, or they just thought nobody builds four-bedroom units, why worry about it? But when it came before the commission, I know I was very concerned and would not have supported it if they were asking for a parking adjustment or not to provide all the parking. I think, that's the way I felt. I don't know if there are others felt that way. But our hands were tied. That's what the code says. They met it. And they had a lot of good arguments, and I didn't listen or watch the tape of the council, but I think the council was stuck with the same thing. So I think really what on that project, they have already got their bonus for parking.
We're not recommending any reductions for parking.
Well, I think that it was already built in. It was already built in there.
Encouraging more units.
Yeah, I would say through a legislative process to amend the code, we'd obviously be coming back to this commission with recommendations in terms of what those parking allowances would be, and it would be a public review process, and the commissions would have input on that code in terms of whether to accept reductions, whether to require increases for a greater number of bedroom units. Those things could all be discussed as part of that review.
I think it might be good to look at that project and see where it fit today and to see if it needed a further bump to get it above the zero line.
They need parking enforcement.
Right. It seems that we are wandering far afield and conclude as it seems. I think what you did on page 39, conclusion, really kind of nailed it. And what we have control of is very little. And the part that we can do is remove development code obstacles to multifamily dwelling development. And I think we can look at those and see where we're going. Because all the other good stuff out there, which is the financing and the market and how all those affect it is the things which we have a little control of. But just taking a look at that final conclusion that says it looks like where we can do the most good is take a look at the development codes and what actually hangs it off. And other than that, I think we have a lot to discuss that we probably need to get to rather than kind of wander.
I think everybody has a certain level of frustration with housing in the Ashland. Is there... Brandon, you started off with the RPS process. Is there any discussion, thought, about solving these issues on a broader palette as a regional basis, like we're going to be industrial and Ashland? Because I know Eco Northwest was involved in all that. Is there discussion about trying to find solutions, by using other jurisdictions?
I did ironically stop and talk to group of friends in Denver on my way down here, and a similar sentiment came up there, thinking about regional solutions. I would say it's pretty well beyond the scope of this project, but it does sound, I think, to answer the question you asked, there might be some willingness to look at ways to think more collaboratively and regionally.
And I do think it would necessitate revisiting the RPS plan as part of one of those periodic, if there was a redistribution of where housing would be located. Currently, we're obligated to provide a 20-year supply based on our population growth on a jurisdictional basis. So Ashland has to meet that standard, Medford has to meet it, Grants Pass has to meet it, and there isn't the potential to say, well, we're going to meet our housing requirement in Central Point. I also think that there has been a effort within the city of Ashland to try and look at housing, workforce housing, as a local need to be resolved, as opposed to bringing people in from Medford to work here and then going back to Medford to live. You know, it's been identified pretty clearly in our housing needs analysis that people that live and work in the same community are more invested in the community. And so to the degree that we can house our workers in Ashland and accommodate our population growth, I think it's incumbent upon us, both under state law and local policy, to do that.
The collaboration I'm referring to is not so much about Ashland not providing housing as about maybe pooling resources, sharing administration of programs and things like that, where there's maybe greater efficiencies and in the dollars that the cities are collecting and putting out in affordable housing programs by administering some of them in a more collaborative way. So not so much about building multifamily in some place other than Ashland.
And in that sense, we are Medford, Ashland Metropolitan Service Area under HUD standards, which includes Medford, Ashland, and everything in between. And so to the degree that we are addressing housing, we have the same affordable housing providers that are working in all jurisdictions, and they can only do one project at a time. And so they are moving from community to community, and that probably is a good way to leverage those efforts.
So there's a number of places in here where you talk about the need for support from overlapping jurisdictions in order to really affect the cost. What's the likelihood of that?
Well, you guys have some conversations scheduled in June. When's this conversation overlapping tax districts
though? Well, it's part of the vertical housing tax credit that went to the Planning Commission, Housing Commission, and City Council. I'm trying to remember the dates. As part of the as a recent effort, the actions involved in that do mean that we'll have to talk with the school district, RV, Rogue Valley Transportation District, Jackson County. You know, Ashland, I think her graphic showed, collects about 27% of the property taxes that are assessed on an individual property. So it's that other 73%
right.
of talking to those taxing districts and seeing if they would be interested in a tax abatement program. You know, one thing that wasn't covered in the presentation was that 10-year limit. We talked about if the development would not occur without the tax incentive. Effectively, you're looking at vacant property for 10 years that's not collecting any tax versus one that gets a tax abatement for 10 years and the building has a lifespan much beyond that, which will be paying full taxes from year 11 onward. So that's kind of the discussion that we'll have to have with the other taxing districts as well.
And I will say on the multi program in particular, you have the option to go it alone. It's not a very powerful program if you do because your taxes aren't the biggest jump.
Right.
But you have that choice if you wanted to do it.
As I recall, the numbers on that look pretty good. I mean, in terms of, oh, okay, you're going to build something that is going to get taxed at full freight. I mean, you get some the first 10 years, and then you get full freight from down. It's a heck of a lot more attractive than, you know, having them develop there.
So folks ready to jump to kind of, I'll wrap up where we landed on recommendations and then really turn it to you.
That'd be great, thank you.
To kind of dig in. So as I said, despite some of the limitations that I mentioned, where we land with this is that it is worth amending your development code, increasing the densities in R2 and R3, increasing the allowed height to 3 stories in the R3 zone to allow true multifamily development, decreasing the parking requirements for smaller units in particular. You could think about maybe just the units under 500 square feet that already get a lot of other special dispensations for being so small. That might be one option. And then maybe a slight increase on lot coverage. And just a side note here, I know in some, in the transit triangle, there's a differentiation about whether these, whether the amendments were available based on tenure. We don't recommend that for your multifamily zone citywide. We recommend making this equally available regardless of tenure. A couple reasons for that, and we've touched on them, so have a few questions if you have any. And then the other questions that are, the other recommendations, so and it's a little bit of an aside, but we did hear about appeals and process and kind of uncertainty as an obstacle, the need for clear and objective standards and process and of path, that the whole path give a clear and objective path through for multifamily infill projects. So just a follow-up that might take some more digging to figure out where the real trip-up points are and address them, but it's something we want to pass along as recommendation. And the annexation policies that Brandon mentioned, that requirement to demonstrate that there's less than a five-year supply of land could be an obstacle if you adopt these and don't change it, and it is, I would argue, already an obstacle for housing affordability. You have an urban growth boundary, that's what its job is. And I think that's, in my mind, that the annexation policy is not, maybe not achieving its purpose at this point in time. And then you're already talking with the overlapping taxing districts, so bring up some of these other tax abatements with them as well and kind of see what the appetite is and where there might be some willingness again, because Mufti is specifically something you're saying isn't happening right now. Maybe there's willingness to have short-term loss of revenue in order to achieve the longer-term. That's all I got.
I'm sorry, quick, can you go back to the, no, it was the last slide that you had up there on revised annexation policies. And then it says eliminate. Those are two, are there, they're both kind of unrelated but related.
Well, the five-year, that you demonstrate a five-year, less than a five-year land supply of the zoning type is currently one of the annexation.
But the only thing that you would be revising in the annexation part is the density pieces?
Just specifically this requirement. We did not look at your annexation policies more broadly. We just said this specific provision.
So it wouldn't go in. Okay,
is challenged.
Yeah. Okay, any general questions about our recommendation, about Ava Northwest's recommendation?
Well, I wanted to ask something about the annexation, which is not really covered in your thing, so I was kind of messing. But I guess the question that I have is it possible to change our requirement to demonstrate five-year land supply for projects that would be bringing in more affordable housing, but not for others?
There is a provision in our annexation criteria that says explicitly exempts inclusion of affordable housing as a demonstrated need to allow for annexation. So that's a separate provision that could be addressed separately. This, again, is the question is about whether it precludes market rate multifamily housing or market rate townhome, R1 3.5, those zones from coming into the city. If it can be demonstrated that there's more than a five-year supply of a multitude of infill projects that aren't infill properties that aren't necessarily on the market, that can be seen as an impediment to annexation. So, but I agree with you, that is a separate criteria that could be looked at.
I don't think you understood my question. I mean, I know what you're talking about. It says that you can't, annex in just to give the affordable housing that's already required when you annex in anyhow, right?
Yep. So that's what the policy says.
Right, exactly.
And it's a policy. And the
right, so I wasn't really asking whether
they ignore it if they want. It's a policy.
They're free to ignore it.
Well, it's just a policy, and prior councils can't tie present-day councils' hands. It's a policy on annexation. It's not a regulation.
Yeah, I apologize. Annexation, I don't remember the criteria directly, but I do recall that there was an annexation provision that said affordable housing is not a public need, something along those lines, which when you're arguing an annexation meets a public need, explicitly affordable housing
right
is not one of those. whereas if that was not in there, somebody
that would be that would be the thing that we would need to have to change. And is there a legal? I mean, is that within the city council?
Yeah.
If you could change that, it's not like some statewide.
Yeah, to answer your question, we could change
that.
And I think our annexation policies have changed over the years, where we used to have it that you could annex easier for an affordable housing project, and then we changed it back. So.
So I just wanted to say from my comment from a policy standpoint is I have easier time with modifying annexation policies, opening up new lands to multifamily development, affordable housing, all of the different needs that we might identify. I think and establishing parameters including high density and low parking requirements, that sort of thing. I think where we've ran into opposition is to the extent that we have smaller lots within already dense neighborhoods, that are, you know, maybe they're not dense from a, you know, broader perspective, but the residents feel like they're already fully developed, already they're built, already streets that are, you know, small in some cases for other reasons, because we've had a transportation plan that doesn't favor large boulevard streets. And trying to adjust the code in a way that makes it possible to develop very densely in little segments within those established neighborhoods. And I just think there are costs and burdens associated with that. So from a policy standpoint, you can say, yes, it's a good thing to incentivize multifamily development, but I think council does have to think about what the reaction of those established neighborhoods are. We've got historic districts, you know, we've got a tourist environment, and I think that all of that has to be taken into consideration in evaluating where we increase density and reduce parking. And like I said, I think it's a little easier when you're talking about new lands because you can develop it with that in mind, but I just think politically, frankly, you know, it's going to be controversial to jump, you know, both feet into, you know, going into, you know, 3 or 4 story buildings full of studio apartments or 4 bedroom, you know, rentals in established neighborhoods. At least that's what we've seen. So from a policy standpoint, I just think council's going to have to consider costs and burdens along with what's going to promote multifamily development and where we really want to do that.
Well, how do people want to discuss this? Do you want to talk about density first, or do you just want to talk more generally about their recommendation? Because nothing, the recommendation is fairly concise. You know, it's, you know, increased density, you know, decrease some of the other burdens, perhaps incrementally, like parking and you know, lot coverage. Does that work? Just to kind of talk about the whole thing at once, rather than breaking them out. You had something to say, Alex?
Oh yeah, I had a question, but go ahead.
Go ahead with the question.
Oh, I wondered to what extent to solve this issue did you look at? You said you looked at mixed use and multifamily. At some point, you said there.
Transit Triangle Project is closer related to
development. Okay. Because I think, do you see a role that can play? I know when we talk about shadow plans on commercial, like Bonmart redeveloping or something, there's like 2 stories of residential in the shadow plan or something, where we can end up, and it almost in commercial redevelops a lot faster than residential. At least in my experience, I think it does. New ideas come in to. You get a cap rate that justifies tearing stuff up more often. Is that some place that we should be looking in addition to these recommendations?
You know, I think the transit triangle development standards for the C1 and the E1 zones in that area are all about how to encourage mixed use with more affordable housing or more housing above. Additionally, the vertical housing tax credits apply to mixed use developments, where the ground floor has a portion of it being commercial, and I don't remember the exact number. We looked at modifying the transit triangle, a mix of commercial on the ground floor, because in Ashland we are seeing that residential is often the driving force, and the ground floor commercial is provided to meet that standard. So it definitely is a part of creating more apartments. This project was isolated to looking at our existing multifamily zones, R2 and R3, and so it doesn't really look at revisiting C1 as a whole or E1 as a whole, the commercial and the employment zones. So that we do allow 30 units per acre, or 15 or 30 units per acre residential on those zones. And those densities may be part of why you're seeing condominiums that are large developed in those zones where we are seeing the mixed use develop. Probably some of the same factors that inform this study.
I just want to respond to your question about how do we respond. And just in the short time that we have, I wonder if we couldn't just look at these specific developments, these specific recommendations. Each one of us take 1 minute to say where we are in relation to those, and we could be all done by 9 o'clock, and it would give a clear thing for our person taking notes about how we stand, unless we're going to take an absolute vote. And I didn't think we were voting, but I don't think we have clarity at all about where we have that, unless each person at least has an opportunity to address those things very quickly.
Just to have a go around of how folks feel about these. I want to make one other quick thing, one other caveat on mixed use development is it costs more to do mixed use than it does to do uses separately, and it's even harder to finance. So over reliance on mixed use, like same building mixed use, is possibly going to magnify the challenges that you have. So with that, I probably should be done talking.
Where do we want to start?
I'll be happy to start.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to say that I very much support the recommendations that are being made from a more of vision for our community is how I'm looking at it. And I'm concerned that I don't want us to become the next leisure world. We do have a rapidly increasing senior population here, and I'm part of it. I want to see young families able to stay here. I want to see workers who are living in some of our 500 square foot apartments who then start having families. I don't want to see them go to Medford. I want them to be able to stay here. And so it seems to me we have been on a path with the cottage housing, with looking at even cooperative living environments, neighborhoods, we're starting to get there. I think we're on the right path. And so, to me, these recommendations keep us going towards that path. It's still a herd of cats on the one side and elephants on the other. And we all need to get them going in the same direction. But I think this is the right direction for us to go. And it means we need more affordable housing. We need to have more rentable units, rentable, affordable housing. And this was a study that what I can see is that's what you're looking at. How can we get there for our families?
Okay, next.
Are we just going around?
Yes.
We can go any way we want. We didn't start at the end.
No, there.
We can.
But sure.
I'll go. I run a nonprofit here in Ashland, and I employ people at the starting wage, you know, a little higher than minimum wage, not much. My staff are working more than one job typically, and they're typically, you know, single adults who are entry level. Living in Medford and trying to work here, there's a lot of problems with that. There's the transportation problem, the communication problem, and you know, people who work here want to be here. I mean, they have an investment in the community that drives them to work in Ashland. We're seeing a lot of pressure from citizens to do something about the housing crisis, you know, in Ashland. And we're also seeing pressure about the studies that the city does and sometimes the lack of results that people see from the studies. This has, you know, very clear delineations of what we can do to help, and I think that we should support it. The only way that we can increase the amount of housing within the city is to increase density or to expand our boundaries. But you know, increasing density is the way to get there, and I think that you have given us some very clear guidelines of what we can do to achieve that. So, you know, with the pressures on local businesses to be able to hire and maintain employees, because it is difficult to find people willing to come to Ashland, and with the pressure to increase, you know, the level of affordability, affordable housing here, I fully support this.
I'm not ready to talk, so I don't like going around. And
okay.
100% in favor of increasing densities. I like our FAR discussions that we had on the transit triangle, and I like to go that way. Increased height, sure, as long as it doesn't challenge our solar access. I'm a little iffy on the parking, just because of the pushback that we've gotten. I like to think that we're headed rather quickly for a future where people won't have cars.
Exactly.
And we won't need that parking. Not quite sure we're there yet, but, you know, I'm willing to entertain that possibility and expectation. I'm not so much into reducing the lot, our lot coverage requirements. I just think that keeping the little bit of greenery that we have in the city there is an important Ashland value. I don't think it's going to get us that much by giving it up.
Well, I'm completely in support of all those. I think that the real answer to what we're looking for rely in the strategies that we haven't discussed. But this is a fine thing that will help us go in the right direction. One that I'm not in favor of, I don't think, is the tax abatement. Looks like a giveaway to me, and I didn't see anything that really, we're having a budget crisis, and we're doing a tax abatement for, that will benefit a few developers to come in and do something that may be slightly good. So I'm not particularly in favor of that.
Next, anybody else?
I was on the school board for many years, and we did an informal survey of our staff at one point. We're a very large employer of people in Ashland, and greater than half of all our staff lived elsewhere, not because they wanted to, but because they couldn't afford to live in Ashland. There's low availability and for family housing, and it was expensive. And so I support all these recommendations. I was particularly impressed with some of the conclusions and some of the suggestions as potential, you pointed out, unintended consequences, that sometimes some of the ideas sound really good, but when you actually look at how it's carried out, you end up shooting yourself in the foot sometimes. So I really appreciated your drawing our attention to some of those issues. I can't remember the specific ones, but I thought it was well done. The study was well done, and I support. I'm not sure about the tax abatement piece, but I support all these. I would really like us to focus on workforce housing and trying to creatively solve some of the problems associated with workforce housing. Some of our largest pieces of land in this community are owned by, for instance, the school district has large tracts of land. businesses own large pieces of land, the Bimart example. What a great opportunity to do workforce housing for Bimart employees above their business. I just think that's a great dream. And I would like to see us work on incentivizing some of those. And that is in the transit triangle, so that would really be feasible. And I don't know what it would take to get that, than to do a project like that. But I would like us to...
The 20 members of the Zupan family would be is the issue.
Great, thank you for your comments.
Yes, we had a whole bunch of items before, but we had a few that were above the zero line, and I think those are the ones we should be focusing on now and explain to the council that we looked at all these, and these are the ones that are above zero. Just to keep looking at all of them together, focus on those ones and try to make the ones above zero work as a starting point. Be doing something. Hopefully those will work, and then work on the ones below zero. But don't try to get them all above zero or whatever. And then a very positive thing, I think, that I always say whenever we get into a code thing, we start people write about the codes and everything, but we look out in the audience, there's no members of the public out there. They're so concerned, but we did get, and we did on the open space, we actually got some correspondence from people who actually do it. We've got two pieces of correspondence here. I think a positive thing is they did say it absolutely won't work. We're wasting time. They've at least looked at it and are willing to participate. And I think working with them and then focusing on those points above zero is, I think, where we should be going at this point.
I can support almost all of this. I think I share the comment that I'm skeptical that the tax abatement will really move the needle and tip a project from not happening to happening nationally. And I share the other comments that probably rather the recommendation was rather than decrease multifamily parking, maybe something a little more broad, like revisit multifamily parking requirements. Because I just don't think there's consensus that decrease is necessarily the way to
do.
I really appreciate having a joint work session, although it looks like most of the decisions sit with the Planning Commission, so we can have all the opinions we want. You guys have the heavy lifting. But I think it's helpful because we have a tendency sometimes to like point to the other commission like they're the problem, they're the problem. And so it's helpful to like actually interact with the same information. I do support this. I am concerned about the tax abatement because I'm concerned about getting a balanced budget in the city. And that's a higher priority to me. I don't know what the other impacts are. I mean, it's easy to say tax abatement without really considering what that means to the next 10 years of the city. So I'm concerned about that one. I'm also concerned that all of this really addresses singles, maybe couples, and students, and families, and what Jackie was saying of we've got these young people, and to keep them in the city when they start to have families, we have to do something. But that's not a reason to not start here, but this isn't the end. This is just the start.
Ben?
I think I already said my...
Okay. Yeah, you had your comments are very, very cogent.
I support that. I actually kind of go with what Melanie was saying, because when I read this whole thing, I go like, well, yeah, that's pretty dismal. As one who grew up here, in a whole different era where we didn't even think about affordable housing, because it was a blue-collar community, pretty much everybody owned their home, and then when we stopped being a blue-collar community, we became a, both a tourist community, which didn't keep up with the wages to afford. Because I've said it over and over, when I graduated in the mid-60s, I couldn't really afford to buy anything here. because already the money had come in to, you know, I could if I weren't so much of a hippie, for sure. You know, but, you know, all in all, it's still...
It's a place to live, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we very much value our hippie factor.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, I love the discussion. I think a lot of these things will be helpful, but my overall feel is that it's, you know, again, a pretty dismal trajectory that the town has gone on. And, look at it.
Okay. Most of that, I actually agree with it all. The only big questions are how much of any one thing one is going to do to get to where they want to go. The increases in density is absolutely necessary, but again, if you look at height more than you can land coverage, you can increase the density without necessarily having to wipe out all the land or take away your FARs. There is a touchy point there about how high you go, and again, Melanie had it right, pretty much it's where they go and how you cover it. The supply letter that came along that was laid out today had a good suggestion that's down in the railroad district where there's very little housing now, but maybe that's something that looks more like a higher vertically than other areas are because some of the buildings are already up there. The parking is a two-phase problem. It's always going to be one. How much you're parking on your lot, how much are you parking somewhere else? The idea that will be carless in a lot of our lifetimes is just not going to happen. It's a wonderful goal, but parking is a problem. Whether you increase it or whether you decrease it, it also needs to balance. I do think what Hayward said earlier, it makes no sense to have a four-bedroom unit that only requires two parking spaces, which is the same as they did for a two-bedroom unit. So those types of things are going to be done when we look at the parking. So reducing it by and large may be a real problem trying to get there. Tax abatements do work. Other communities have used them. They can get you there. They're not a free giveaway like everybody likes to believe because that's caused a lot more lack of understanding of how taxes work than in reality of how you do tax abatements. And one of the things that just points out a lot more is we need more land. How we get it, whether it's increasing the urban boundary or is it by how we bring people in, other land that we actually can bring in is going to be a problem. And as long as we keep only the land we have, that puts upward pressure on the price to make sure it keeps going up. And it drives it up to every time you build another project, that takes a piece of land out of it. So everybody around you says, I can raise my prices now because there's that much less land. So one of the other things that this does discuss, but it doesn't maybe take it far enough, is that we need to add more land into the overall. Whether you look at only doing it with the methodology we now have, or do we actually look at increasing that urban boundary to be able to do it, which takes the pressure off. Just like building new structures, I thought the report did a great job of not only saying where to go, but what causes the problems for us trying to get there. Just like the idea of building new housing, even though the houses are 2,000 square feet and they only go for the upper class, it takes pressure off the lower housing because that means there's a house down there that somebody won't decide to renovate and take off the market. And so even though we're only looking at this on one side, which is how do we build only more at a mid-level or low-income level, if you're building more at the upper income level, it does take pressure off the lower income level to a certain extent. Land does the same thing. So I like the report by and large. I like the elements that explain why certain upward mobility things don't work and certain lower things that it seems intuitively obvious would work, they don't work either. So because of that, I think the report was done well. But I do think our final phase in this is a lot about numbers. If you increase the density in any district, by how much? If you go up higher, in where, when, how much? So it's always going to matter of numbers from here on out. Oh, and there is one thing they bring up, and that is the community discussions, the problem with development, this community comes out in arms. That's not going to change. So that one paragraph about, let's take a look at that as a way to lower development costs, forget that one. It is not going to fly. Let them know ahead of time, the only other thing you can do at the area maybe is don't charged them to actually do it, but other than that, that one's a dead one.
Well, can I just say, I wanted to commend you on your presentation, too. That was excellent, excellent. The report was excellent, and your presentation was really excellent. You know, very understandable and straightforward.
Thank you. And you guys are an incredibly attentive and audience, and I am amazed at how many of you read past the first page. For that, well done. I appreciate the depth of conversation.
They actually read it. I totally agree that I think that the report is a great tool for both our committees and for the council to use. It really helps to have that much data and that depth of analysis, even though it's a difficult problem we're facing. And this isn't going to be a magic bullet, but we do definitely need to increase the community. But we do that by increasing the number of units you can build, or by some sort of FAR regime, say, figure out, okay, this is how much bulk we want in R3. This is how much bulk we want in R2. And maybe have a minimum unit requirement, but you can put, you know, the number of units you want in that bulk. That's sort of what we did in the transit triangle. To me, that works better. Maybe it's just because I'm more familiar with those sort of schemes that all the jurisdictions are practiced in. And one thing they were taught, that some of the developers were talking about, they were complaining about, oh, we're getting forced into all these discretionary approvals. And I think what they're talking about is for, you know, to be able to get enough in, unless you're doing the four-bedroom things, mm-hmm. you got to apply for a lot of bonuses to have any chance of making something pencil. And, the bonuses are, they're complicated and they're sometimes difficult to comply with. And sometimes it's hard to fit it all into your site. So one thing we might think about is just increasing the density and, doing one of the bonuses requiring open space. But increasing the density to where you want the density instead of, worrying about, you get this little bit, you get a minimum density and then we're going to try to bump it up with these things we like. Require the things you like and let them build for the number of units that makes sense. We won't have anything to argue about, but geez.
You can buy something, don't you? Yeah, okay.
Thanks. And, I agree that parking is a tough nut. I've seen residential or restricted parking zones work really well in a lot of jurisdictions where you just don't let people park in the street. If they have too many cars, too bad. There's nowhere to park it. Unless you get a sticker, you can't park in the street or you get a ticket. Those actually work. I'm not sure we can give everybody a place to park every car that they want to buy. I just don't think there's enough room in the city for that and to have the kind of density we would like. And the tax abatement stuff, I think, needs studied. People really pointed out the issues with it, but I've seen them work really well. In a lot of jurisdictions, the multifamily tax exemption in Seattle worked great, and in some neighborhoods, that type project would have been built anyway. But in a lot of neighborhoods, that multifamily project absolutely would not have been built without the multifamily tax exemption. So, I think there are some safeguards in it, and it's something the council needs to look at closely. And of course, they have to. As Melissa says, they have other budget issues besides us. So thanks, any other final comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing. I found it really interesting. I have this Oregonian article from Tuesday, April 24th, 1979. Oh. It's battle lines drawn over in Ashland over condominiums. And a lot of it is So totally interesting that a lot of it is exactly the same thing that we've just been discussing right now, yeah, about how the taking zoning away from this to be able to have the affordable type units. The reason I have this, it is the very condominium that I live in that's on the front here, and my grandmother had bought one of them before they broke ground.
But I found another stack of newspapers.
Yeah.
And look, here's me. Oh, and here's me. Yes.
Actually, they have some of that.
Why are you guessing?
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
I love the country. I'm out there. I signed it today.
Yeah.